I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we.
Welcome to EcoTalk, and a very special welcome to those of you who are joining us for the first time, perhaps, thanks to our new and improved broadcast time slot. Every Saturday you can hear us now. That's noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. here on the West Coast, and in between hours for those of you in between the two coasts. Also want to share some exciting news about a new partnership that we're kicking off today with an environmental organization that should be very familiar to EcoTalk listeners, and that is the NRDC. EcoTalk is proud to be sponsored by the Natural Resources Defense Council, the nation's leading environmental action organization. The NRDC uses law, science, and the support of more than 1.2 million members and online activists to protect the planet's wildlife and wild places and to ensure a safe, healthy environment for all living things. Now, we have another Great Green Hour planned for you. In our first segment, we'll talk about two key items in the news over the past week or so. President Bush calling on Americans to conserve gas. Wow, what a surprise. By driving less. Well, is that the best we can do? That is, the sale of SUVs, especially the largest gas guzzlers sold by GM and Ford mostly, are going down as fast as the price of a gallon of fuel is going up. Our second segment is an interview with Jacques Leslie, who wrote an interesting new book called Deep Water. It's a fascinating narrative about the power and the costs of dams, both in human and ecological terms. And in our second half, we will hear from three recipients of the David Brower Youth Awards. You'll find their stories of eco-activism and heroism quite inspiring, I think. And last but not least, we'll look at coal at the crossroads. Is there such a thing as clean coal? But first, let's turn our attention to W's request to ask Americans this week to please drive less, only drive if necessary. Well, I would say with gas hovering around $3 per gallon higher here in the Bay Area, that's probably already happened. To talk a little bit more about that and perhaps why that is not nearly enough, we're going to bring in Lowell Unger. He's a senior policy analyst with the Alliance to Save Energy, which, coincidentally or not, has a campaign to try to get more consumers to contact their legislators and ask them to improve CAFE standards, corporate average fuel efficiency standards. And if that's an issue that sounds like it's come up before and usually defeated, well, it's the issue that won't go away. Nope, not as gas prices, oil prices continue to rise, as the ravages of Hurricane Katrina show us just how vulnerable we are to our addiction to oil and our use of fossil fuels. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What was your thought when you heard President Bush asking Americans to drive less?
Well, we think that's a good idea. We do public and consumer education ourselves, urging people to drive less, to inflate tires. That's all very good. However, it's not enough. Right now, we have a shortage of oil in this country due to the hurricanes of a million barrels a day. We're importing more than half of our oil from foreign countries, much of it from rather dangerous parts of the world. We simply need to do more, and we need to make cars more efficient. That's the only way we're going to save that oil.
And, of course, driving less is, like you said, just the very beginning, the first step, and yet it's taken this long for him to get this far. It almost seemed like he was, like, choking on the word conservation, you know? Like, it's so hard, so hard to ask. It's such a sacrifice.
We are cooperating with the Department of Energy, and they do some public education, but they have only a pittance of money with which to do it. We need a serious public education campaign. I think you're out in California. In California, faced an electricity crisis. They spent $20 million. They had advertising. They had rebates. They had a massive campaign, and people responded. They saved 10% of electricity use in less than a year. That's the kind of serious campaign we need nationwide on oil and on natural gas right now.
And the big sellers of SUVs had a campaign this summer because of slow sales as Americans start to catch on to how they're paying through the hose at the pumps to try to incentivize buying the biggest gas guzzlers. Ford's Excursion, which I like to call Extinction, is on its last leg. I think they just made the last one, none too soon. And they were offering incentives for people to, you know, buy the bigger guzzlers at, you know, less price, less interest, less financing costs. And as that winds down, I think that's where they're really seeing this pretty significant drop in SUV sales, I think down 43% from a year earlier.
That's right. The long-term trend has been that SUVs have grown from nothing to being more than half of the vehicle market recently, but the bottom seems to have dropped out of the market. With prices where they are, the sales, especially of the large SUVs, are plummeting. Interestingly, sales of the small SUVs, the so-called crossover models, actually are rising right now. We have no problem with people driving SUVs, actually. We just think they should be efficient SUVs, that there are technologies that can make cars much more efficient right now, and they will save people money in the long run, especially when prices are at $3 a gallon.
So why are we still not seeing much in the way of more efficient cars, more hybrids being offered from more companies?
Unfortunately, especially the domestic car manufacturers saw that they could make the highest profits with these big SUVs, and that's where they put the emphasis. We certainly need consumers to pay attention to fuel economy, to choose cars that get more miles per gallon, but we also need the government. There's a federal interest here. I say this is a national security issue. This is an environmental issue. And we really need policies in place that will require that the car companies put in the fuel-efficient technologies. It's not that people have to drive the tiny vehicles or to really constrict consumers. It's to make sure that the vehicles we have are the most efficient that they can be.
And just a few weeks ago, there was an opinion poll showing that the majority of Americans, strong majority, favor stricter CAFE standards. Why is this administration and some legislators, why are they so reluctant to initiate what would essentially be, you know, American innovation and technology that the Japanese car makers have been using for years, and by the way, you know, with long waiting lists for all the hybrid models, including Ford's, by the way.
That's right. The most recent poll I saw showed that 86% of Americans supported stronger fuel efficiency standards, and that was true for Democrats and for Republicans. It was not a partisan issue.
So what about that don't they get? What don't they hear?
And this hasn't been a partisan issue in Congress either. It's been more of a regional issue. The problem, frankly, is the American automobile manufacturers are very strong. They employ lots of people. They have lots of suppliers who employ lots more people. And right now, unfortunately, Congress is paying more attention to these few companies than they are to the voters. What's going to change that is if the voters say, look, this is important to us. We not only feel that standards should be improved, but we're going to vote on that. When this becomes an issue that is important to their constituents, that is going to make a difference whether they get elected to office or not, then Congress is going to respond.
There was one car dealer quoted in this New York Times article earlier this week in the business section on the drop of SUV sales, and he said, where 3 years ago no one really ever asked about fuel efficiency and mileage, now that's the first question that families are asking, and families, of course, are the primary drivers, if you will, of SUVs.
Well, you know, the American auto manufacturers for years have been saying that, oh, the consumers don't care about fuel economy. It's number 14 on their list of priorities for vehicles. In the meantime, at the same time, the companies that were making fuel-efficient vehicles were running all the way to the bank. As you said, there are waiting lists for these hybrids. Right now, Toyota makes by far the most hybrids available in the American market, and they don't have to pay people to buy their vehicles. They don't have to provide these large incentives. They're making profits. So there has always been a disconnect. The car companies said the Americans didn't care about fuel economy, but the companies that made the fuel-efficient cars were the ones that were selling vehicles.
So that raises a really important question. If the market is finally now demanding more fuel-efficient cars, do we need legislation to improve CAFE standards?
Well, we certainly hope that fuel economy would improve without this legislation, but the history is even as fuel efficiency improves in some cars, the manufacturers sell other cars that are less efficient, and were held at a standstill. People should buy more efficient cars. We shouldn't necessarily need fuel economy standards, but again, there are national issues at stake here, and this is the most effective, the most sure way to make sure that our vehicles are using less oil, they're less polluting, and that they are saving consumers money.
And GM's Robert Lutz, you know, keeps saying these quotes that I go, He said a few months ago, we're going to continue making our large SUVs. We think that this high gas prices are just temporary. And in this article, he's also quoted again as saying, we expect gas prices to go down below $2 a gallon. He said, I'll bet on it. I bet he's wrong.
I'm not going to predict exactly what gas prices are going to be. There's no doubt that they will go up and go down and go back up again. But the long-term trends are that not only is the U.S. using more and more oil, we're by far the world's largest consumer, but China is using far more oil than it used to. India is using more oil. There's greater and greater demand around the world, and there doesn't seem to be greater and greater supply.
That's right.
So in the long run, there certainly is going to be upward pressure on oil prices and gasoline prices. We're not going to fix this from supply-side solutions. We need to decrease demand.
Great.
We need to improve
Thank
fuel
you.
Efficiency.
Fred, we're out of time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we.
Welcome back to EcoTalk, and we are welcoming to our studios the author of a just-published book, very important, powerful book, about dams. It's called Deep Water, The Epic Struggle Over Dams, Displaced People, and the Environment. And the author of this great piece of work is Jacques Leslie. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Interesting that you're writing about dams. There's a book out about Hetch Hetchy right now, and you're taking a look at some individual stories that took place around the globe, both, you know, man versus nature, man versus man, and the folly of man trying to tame nature. And it comes at a time when we're seeing what happened with the levees, of course, on the Gulf Coast, where, you know, it's really kind of a Faustian bargain. You, on the one hand, get the levees and you get development and prosperity, but of course it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature too much, and now we're seeing the consequences of that. You have a story about three different people, and you sort of track the good, bad, and ugly of dams through them.
Well, the three of them were all commissioners on something called the World Commission on Dams, and they came from very different points of view. When they were drawn for the commission, one was considered anti-dam, one in the middle, and one pro-dam. And I chose the most interesting of each commissioner out of in that category, so that the anti-dam person is Medha Patkar, considered the world's foremost anti-dam activist, a woman in India who has tried to drown herself in rising reservoir waters and has been on hunger strikes of up to 26 days in opposing a huge dam in western India.
Literally tried to drown herself?
That's right. In fact, the section of the book about her deals with my going to see her when she was making an attempt to do that. She'd already tried once, and the water had reached above her neck, and the police grabbed her at the last moment to prevent having the Indian government having to deal with the embarrassment of her death.
That's a heck of a price for making a statement. Was she so depressed from this struggle, or was she actually just willing to sacrifice her life to get attention?
I think she really wanted to give her life, and probably still does. She had tried before and may try again. Her hunger strikes put her right on the edge of death. She wanted to embarrass the government so that it would reconsider its zeal for dams.
Well, what did she see that, you know, that is the ultimate price? Her life. She was willing to give her life for this struggle.
Well, this dam displaced, or is in the process of displacing, 200,000 or 300,000 people, maybe more than that. Most of them are indigenous people who'd been in the same region along the river for hundreds of years. Not only were their lives being shattered by being forced to move, but their culture was being shattered along with it. And that's very often the case in dams around the world. There have been 40 to 80 million people who've been displaced by dams.
Bill McKibben, by the way, has a great review of your book in this edition of On Earth, the Natural Resources Defense Council, great publication, and they are our sponsor and environmental partner, so that ties in nicely. And one of the things he said is dams will end up being the relics of the 20th century, along with Stalinism and gasoline-powered cars, symbols of the allure of technology and its transience of the top-down, growth-at-all-costs era of development and international banks, of the delusion that humans are exempt from nature's dominion of greed and indifference to suffering.
Those are my words.
Oh, I'm sorry. There is a quote in there, so yes. Why will these be relics of an era gone by?
Well, we're already learning all the damage that they caused. The United States, which used to be the leading dam-building country in the world, now leads the world in taking them down. And we're slowly letting that lesson pass to the developed world, where there's still a lot of enthusiasm, but they can't last that long. All dams die. And at that point, they become very expensive waterfalls. And that's what's going to happen.
I guess your book, among other things, really looks at the upstream and downstream impacts, human impact, human toll on man trying to, again, you know, control nature. And was it innocent, or, you know, is there some nefarious goal here in operation? We just didn't know enough, but now we do, but you say it's still taking place.
Oh, I'd say it's the sin of hubris. When Hoover was built, the Secretary of the Interior declaimed at the dedication, man acclaims his conquest of nature. Well, man doesn't win those battles for very long.
And ultimately, the ecological costs and human costs do catch up with us. When will the lesson about dams really penetrate? Is that starting to happen? Are you starting to see a shift?
Oh, it is starting. And as I say, it started in the United States. That's why we now take more dams down than we build. But in the developing world, they're still being built. People want water and power, and we have to come up with alternate ways of providing those.
You did a lot of traveling to put this book together, and you say it took about 4 years to put together. I believe it. It's a real, you know, comprehensive look, but written through an interesting narrative perspective.
Well, thank you. I did go on about 5 trips to Africa, Australia, and India, and loved all of those experiences. Rich, very rich.
Are you surprised at what's happening with the levees, that we're seeing the fallout of, you know, man trying to control where the water flows?
Right. It's the same story. It's the control of nature. The victories are all temporary. Someone I was just reading about, an engineer, said that there are two kinds of levees, those that have already failed and those that will.
And ultimately, humanity will fail if we don't learn our lessons more quickly and, I think, more dramatically.
That's right.
The book is called Deep Water, The Epic Struggle Over Dams, Displaced People and the Environment. The author is Jacques Leslie. I really encourage you to pick it up. It's a really good study on, some of the mistakes we're making, what we can learn from them, and hopefully people in other countries will pick it up as well. Will it be published in other languages?
I hope so.
I hope so, too. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Beth.
You're listening to EcoTalk on Air America Radio, and when we come back, you will meet some young recipients of the David Brower Youth Awards. You'll meet some kids from around the country who have done extraordinary environmental deeds. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The land, and we poison the water we drink, and we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell, and more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years, when we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere.
Welcome back to EcoTalk, and I hope you find this segment as inspiring as I think you will, because we are going to be talking about the environmental activists of tomorrow, except they've already gotten a jump start. 3 teenagers from around the country who have done work that is so extraordinary. They stand out to be among the 7 recipients of the David Brower Youth Award. They are in the Bay Area to receive their award this week, and among a lot of notoriety and a great trip to Point Reyes, a hiking, camping trip, they also get $3,000 in prize money to do what you want. I bet knowing them, they're probably going to apply it to the work they've done. So joining us in studio first is Xander Schrodes, a 15-year-old from Florida, and you're working to save the sea turtles?
Right, yeah. I started the program when I was about 11 years old with a grant from the Venice Foundation, which is an area around us. And I started the project with this grant with the inspiration from a lady named Linda Soderquist. She showed me what's going on our beaches with the local sea turtles. And I started the program with just whatever I could find. I developed a sea turtle costume that I let the kids see the anatomy of the sea turtle. And I have ping pong balls, which are about the same size of a sea turtle egg. And I let them bury them in a sandbox. And then I show a slideshow. And the kids are learning a lot, and so are the parents. Because the kids and the parents don't know what they're doing on the beaches that they're hurting the turtles. They're littering on the beaches. They're leaving beach furniture down there. So they don't know what's hurting them. And if they're just educated on what they're doing, they're going to stop. They're not trying to harm the environment or anything. So I've gone around to different schools and libraries and, like, Sarasota Reading Festival and just reading festivals like that. And currently I've just finished my activity book. It's called Turtle Talks, the activity book, which goes along with the program, and it gives kids something to take home so they can show their parents and then through word of mouth educate their parents on what they're doing. Because there's in Florida we have lots of tourists that come down from the northern states, and they come down and they're on the beaches having a good time, but they don't know what they're doing wrong. They're throwing the plastic bags in the water, which the sea turtles are eating. And
so they're along public beaches where people are just walking and doing their usual trashing?
The sea turtles come up and they nest at night, and then we have beach walkers that go and mark the beaches where the nest is, and so that's how we can record the data. But yeah, so they're right on the beaches that thousands of tourists come down to every year.
Wow, people are probably surprised to learn about this and grateful that you're alerting them.
Yeah, I go around and do a lot of beach cleanups too, or just give people a paper bag that they fill up with trash, and they'd be amazed what they can find.
Xander Schrodes, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be looking to hear more about your work saving the loggerhead sea turtles from extinction along the Florida coast. And our next recipient in studio is Andrea Garza. You are from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And among other things, you started protesting a proposed nuclear waste facility in your community?
Right. I'm originally from Brownsville, Texas. And I was 13 years old when I heard of this proposed nuclear waste dump site happening in Sierra Blanca, Texas, which is a ways away from Brownsville. And so I kind of thought it would be great to join this statewide campaign that was happening, not just statewide, but also internationally with the, you know, communities that are right along the border on the Mexican side. And so I formed a group of young people, and we joined the statewide campaign, and we attended hearings in Sierra Blanca. We attended protests at the state capitol and joined efforts with a lot of other organizations and individuals who were fighting for the same thing. And we took our ancient form of prayer, which is Aztec dance, to the community of Sierra Blanca and held that ceremony there to pray for the community. And that was like the first success. It was a success that the dump site didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
It didn't happen. And
can you claim some of the credit for that?
A little bit.
Uh-huh.
You know,
good for you.
There was a lot of other, you know, folks and organizations that were involved in mm-hmm. kind of like this.
But you represented the youth voice.
Right.
And what did that do to sort of reaffirm your understanding of the power of one?
Well, I definitely think, because it was like the first kind of direct first-hand campaign that we were involved in, and then to see it and successfully was very inspirational and allowed us to continue doing the, you know, work that we have done since then. And after Sierra Blanca, we kind of stayed organized as a group and started organizing around issues like the militarization of the border. We started a Know Your Rights campaign to inform the community and create community awareness around human rights and what to do when you're stopped or detained by immigration.
What are you working on now? Is that your project now?
Actually, now this project of Esperanza Unida in Brownsville, Texas was started 8 years ago when I was 13.
Oh,
and
wow.
I left Brownsville when I was 17 years old, And the project still exists to this day. It's still very active. The young people are still very involved, and they're still doing lots of great work that I support. And I, you know, go back there several times a year to support the events that the young people are still doing. But currently I moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I work with a project there called Young Women United, which is an organizing project created by and for young women of color in Southeast Albuquerque.
Well, what does it mean to you to get this prestigious award?
I feel very honored to be recognized along with these six other amazing young people who are doing amazing work all over the country. And so I just feel very, very honored and very blessed to be recognized in this way.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And our third recipient of the David Brower Youth Awards joining us in studio is Daniel Rosen, a 19-year-old from Flagstaff, Arizona.
How you doing?
Congrats. And you attended a summit, I understand, called Healing and Redefining Our World Youth Summit, and that was kind of an eco-epiphany of sorts for you?
Yeah. I moved out the following year to where I came in Flagstaff, Arizona, to help organize another summit called the All People's Power Summit, Building Communities of Hope, Strength, and Sustainability. And this was part of a project of organizations called the Black Mesa Water Coalition and Native Movement. Black Mesa Water Coalition is organized around the effort to stop Peabody Coal Company's wasteful pumping of pristine drinking water from the Navajo and Hopi people, which slurries coals to the Mojave Generating Station and produces power for L.A. and other cities in the Southwest. But the Navajo people, many of them still don't have electricity, even though this great source of energy is being pumped from them, and it's taking the water away. All whole aquifers have collapsed. So it's part of a broader environmental justice project that's been going on for nearly 30 years since Peabody Coal started mining.
And you're still organizing summits for youth?
We had our last summit out in Hopi, and the theme behind that summit was the art and earth. It was how art can be incorporated in action. Bertolt Brecht said that art is not a mirror to hold up to reality, but a hammer to shape it. And many youth in our organization are using spray paint, they're using poetry, they're using different kinds of independent media to change the world, shape it, to mold it, and using art as a means of creating change. And it's a powerful thing. And we also, at that summit, were helping our friend Lillian Hill, who lives out in Kokotsumovi Hopi, build her house that's out of mud and clay. And that's also an art form, is natural building, sustainable building.
I like this quote attributed to you. You say, "We are essentially firefighters putting out one bad policy after another. These gatherings," I presume you're referring to the summits, "allow us to have a perspective of where we are in the battle and where we need to be going."
Exactly. I think with every organization, we need to have the ability to create space for ourselves as organizers, as people, as families, to get together and take a step back and look at our approach. And I think the more that's incorporated into our work in terms of supporting each other in this way, the more effective our work will be. And I think it's really important for youth, particularly youth from impacted communities, to get together and share ideas about different struggles going on, because it's all one struggle, you know. Like Andrea here was working on in stuff in Albuquerque, but it completely relates to what we have going on in Flagstaff and the rest of northern Arizona. And the fact that we're able to meet in this type of situation and unite as different organizations only makes us stronger. So it's a really important thing to bring together people who are working on similar issues in different places to build a movement that goes cross and interregional.
And how do these activities affect what you want to do as you go through college and out into the world?
And people always ask me, you know, what do you want to be when you get older? And I always tell them, you know, what I'm doing right now, I think there's nothing more
good.
Exciting.
We need you, all of you.
There's nothing more exciting than seeing youth get together and start to shape the world in a way that can make positive impact on people's lives and really take hold of our destiny, not just submit to it, but say, you know what, we have a role in this, and beyond that, we're going to shape it. And I think that's a powerful thing once you realize that responsibility.
And what is this public recognition that you're getting mean to you and your work?
You know, it's probably one of the honors of my life to be standing up on that stage with the young women from Northern California, Andrea, and the rest of them. I think it really shows for the first, for, you know, to me, that youth are not only being recognized, but we're really, really important to this movement. Without youth, there will be no longevity within the environmental or any social justice movement. And the support we are getting is really, really necessary and needed. And I'd like to thank Earth Island Institute and any other nonprofit or organization or family or community that's supporting work young people are doing, because in the end, that's the work that will be primary and it will always be primary.
I love what you say. It's the honor of a lifetime, and you're only 19. May you have many honors ahead of you and much great work ahead of you for all of you.
Thank you for having us today.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Thank you for doing what you do. Congratulations again from EcoTalk. You're listening to the show that is greening the red and blue states one show at a time, and we will be right back with more Green Talk for you. Stay with us.
And waste so much, how much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes.
Welcome back to Eco Talk, and I think you're going to find this last segment of our show today quite interesting. I certainly am looking forward to it because we've heard President Bush talk about clean coal along with nuclear as being an answer to some of our fossil foolishness. And I've wondered, is there such a thing? I usually mutter under my breath, no such thing. But the cover issue of On Earth, put out by the NRDC, our new sponsor, is about just that topic, coal at the crossroads, coal coming cleaner. Is there a way to burn the stuff without toasting the planet? And to find out more, we're going to check in now with Dave Hawkins. He is with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's the director of their Climate Center in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Okay, so is there such a thing, and is it in reality or just planning stages, a cleaner version of dirty coal?
It's possible to use coal and keep its pollutants out of the atmosphere, including the global warming pollutant, carbon dioxide. It's possible, but until we have policies that actually make large polluters like the electric power sector cut their global warming pollution, this technology won't be used. So the challenge is getting the policies in place, but the technology is there, and it's even affordable.
And there are plans to build new power plants, coal-powered plants. Are they going to be built with cleaner technology, or not at this point is that planned?
No, the power plants that are on the drawing boards today and that are being financed by Wall Street today are the old-fashioned dirty coal plants. They are using 200-year-old technology, and they would continue to pollute the planet for their lifetime, and their lifetime is about as long as a human lifetime. A power plant built today will be operating probably by the time that a child born today is eligible for Social Security, if that exists then.
And carbon dioxide, of course, being one of the emissions, and there's a pretty long shelf life for that in the atmosphere, I understand.
It is. Once a ton of carbon dioxide goes up into the atmosphere, 100 years from now, about a half a ton will still be in the atmosphere. So this is something that we are, definitely going to leave to our children and their children and their children. If we put it up there today, the consequences are going to be felt by generations to come.
Now, what about these coal-fired power plants that we understand are putting more methyl mercury into the air, which then gets into our water systems, into our fish, into our bodies? Is that being addressed?
It is not being addressed adequately, yes. Mercury is a brain poison, and the coal-fired power plants are a huge source of mercury in the United States and around the world. Again, there is technology to radically cut the mercury that is released from a coal plant, but the current administration isn't requiring that technology to be used. Instead, they cut a sweetheart deal with the industry that lets them pollute this brain poison at levels 2 to 3 to 4 times what the technology could do.
As best you can, Dave, tell us how this cleaner coal technology would actually work.
Sure. It starts by taking the coal and turning it into a gas, basically putting it into a pressure cooker that creates a very strong gas with a high energy content. That gas contains some CO2 that can be stripped off. The carbon dioxide can be stripped off. Then you have to do something with the CO2. And what you would do with it is put it under very high pressure so that it turns into a liquid, and then pipe it into underground geologic formations. Now, what do I mean by these underground formations? I don't mean a big cave. Think about a very salty sponge about a mile below the surface of the earth that is covered by a very thick brick-like formation that is impenetrable, and you'll have an idea of what kind of formations we're talking about. This is these formations exist around the world, and they have the capacity to absorb large amounts of CO2. And if we manage it correctly, that CO2 could be kept down in those formations indefinitely. And by indefinitely, I mean for tens of thousands of years.
And lest anyone think that coal is a dying technology, it says here the International Energy Agency expects a 43% increase in the use of coal between the year 2000 and 2020.
Yes, and if you take those projections out just a little bit longer to 2030, so you're dealing with the next 25 years, the astounding statistic is that the new coal plants that are going to be built around the world in the next 25 years, during their operating lives, will consume more coal than has been consumed in all of human history up to this point.
Wow. So people who are listening to this interview, what can they do if they would like to see the new coal technology be a whole lot cleaner?
Well, they can do several things. First, they can go to www.nrdc.org, and on our global warming page, there's more information on this, as well as in the On Earth article, which is also available on our website. But they can contact both their electric company and you know, just put a note in their bill the next time they send it back saying what kind of coal-fired power plants do you operate and what do they do with the CO2. If they are stockholders in power companies, they can participate in some stockholder campaigns. Everyone has a congressman or woman and a senator, and a short note saying, what are you doing to support the clean energy technologies, including efficiency, renewable energy, and if we're going to use coal that captures its CO2, would be helpful. The Edison Electric Institute is the lobbying organization for the electric power industry. And again, just a short note to them, you know, the fact that they get any mail at all from the public, you know, tends to cause people to there to perk up and say, gee, we're not really handling this issue very well. But there are activities like this that are suggested at our website. Really only a couple of minutes of people's time can make a difference.
Terrific. We're out of time, I'm afraid. But thanks for enlightening us on the possibilities of a cleaner coal future. We've been speaking with Dave Hawkins, the director of the Climate Center for the NRDC in Washington, D.C. Go out and have a great green week. See you next time.